It is a pleasure today to have Dr. Sahar Zafar here. She is an associate professor in the Department of Neurology at Mass General Brigham. She is also the Vice Chair of Quality and the Assistant CMO at Mass General Brigham. She is subspecialty trained in neurocritical care and clinical neurophysiology. And today I would like to get into some of your work using AI modeling and looking at neurocritical care and epilepsy outcomes, because you've done some amazing things so far. And I really would like to sort of dig into that and learn a little bit more about some of your work. So welcome.
Thanks. Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Okay. So Sahar, can you talk a little bit broadly about your AI work, how you started, and what kind of modeling you're particularly interested in?
Sure, absolutely. And maybe I'll just start by talking a little bit more about the motivation for the line of work. You know, I think my interest, going through neurocritical care and then my clinical neurophysiology training has always been focused both clinically and from a research and also from a quality perspective on improving seizure management, ICU EEG guided treatment, both in the acute setting, but also long term. So not just in the ICU, but, you know, many of our patients, as you know, Jen, they get treated, you know, with 2, 3, 4 seizure medications for seizures or other abnormal EEG patterns, and then are discharged on those medications. And many of them stay on these lifelong because people don't really know when or how to taper them off. And I think one of the biggest challenges has been in how do we answer, you know, the question of what is the optimal treatment strategy in neurocritical care and acute neurology? In most fields, we rely on randomized controlled trials to answer many of our questions. But in neurocritical care, and I think specifically also for this question, it is very hard to answer just given, the complex neurophysiology of these patients. It's not one brain injury, right? They can have, you know, whether it's stroke or trauma or intracerebral hemorrhage, we see seizures and periodic arrhythmic patterns have a similar signature across all of these. And we don't know what the diagnostic or prognostic significance is and how it varies across etiology. Then there's the whole secondary brain injury piece and how that plays into, what is an epiphenomenon versus what is causing true secondary brain injury. Then there's not just the neurophysiology, there's systemic derangements with, you know, renal failure, heart failure, liver failure. So it's just a complex population to study. We don't know which drugs we should study. We sort of use drugs that are used in a healthy population and apply the same PK, pharmacokinetic principles, but they probably, you know, I think we have enough evidence to show that that varies in this population. We don't know what EEG endpoints to target. And so it makes it hard to design a trial. Second, it's hard to recruit and making these trials very infeasible, which is why they don't really exist. There's not very many trials. I think there was just one trial, which is the Telstar trial looking at anoxic brain injury patients and cardiac arrest, where they randomized to treating versus not treating GPDs and, basically found you don't need to aggressively treat, but I don't think you can draw any definitive conclusions. And it's a very, you know, distinct population. And so,
right.
You know,
I was just going to say, we know from doing all of the seizure guidelines, prophylactic guidelines together, that the data is scant.
Very limited.
What
yes.
is has a lot of limitations to it. And particularly, you know, in regards to, you know, 2 helps 2B scoring and what do we do with that in terms of long-term prophylaxis is such an open question. And I know you're doing a lot of work on that.
Yeah.
I'm excited to hear how to tackle some of these issues.
So I think for me, what became apparent and what I, you know, we decided to leverage was that just, you know, in a way, while it's, you know, it's unfortunate we don't have robust guidelines or data, it actually leads to practice variation. Uh-huh. And so when I was on my K23, part of my training plan was to do a master's of science in epidemiology, got to work with, you know, some experts in the field that use real world data to do natural experiments and emulated trials and other, you know, simulated trials. And that's what, you know, led me to looking into, is that an approach we could use for this question and this population? And so, again, I started off with smaller studies, you know, cohorts of 200 or 300 patients, where you can, you know, it took a year to review all the raw EEG data for 300 subarachnoid hemorrhage patients to annotate it down to every second and review their charts and pull out their MRS scores. But when you have small cohorts of 200 or 300 patients, again, we deal with, you know, confounding bias and all the other limitations, immortal time bias that exists with these smaller studies. So we're, you know, I was in this place where a randomized trial right now is infeasible, and we need some data driven strategies to get to a randomized trial. Small cohort studies, great, but we can't draw any causal inference or conclusions from them. So the middle ground is using large, richly annotated observational data that is multi-center, linking clinical EHR data with neurophysiologic data, and then doing advanced causal analytics such as emulated target trials, looking at reinforcement learning, trial simulations, and also use that data actually to design data-driven randomized control trials. The whole purpose of this research is, can we use large observational data to at least find signals of what an optimal treatment strategy could be that, you know, we could then test in a feasible trial, or signals that clearly demonstrate a treatment strategy seems to be working, and, you know, is there a way to implement this in clinical practice and then, you know, follow to see if it helps improve outcomes. But to be able to do that, we first have to annotate all the EHR data, all the EEG data, all the medication data that we have. And that's where, when we started to use and implement the various different AI algorithms, which includes natural language processing for our electronic health records. We've used multiple deep learning convolution neural networks for the EEG annotation, and pulling out, you know, data about medications and trying to model their pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics. So the AI, you know, it's used for multiple purposes, and I'm happy to, Jen, you tell me where to start. We can talk about how we annotated EHR data, what we did with neurophys data, approaches that we've used for all.
Yeah, I'm interested in if you guys contemplated doing some self-supervised learning, because you probably have massive amounts of EEG data just to set up like a EEG foundation models. Have you tried that?
So we did the EEG models. So the initial, and this is work that, you know, I my mentor and now close colleague and collaborator, Brandon Westover, I have to give a lot of credit to him and his lab as well, since they've pioneered a lot of the work in EEG, was using, you know, it's basically, we started off with these semi-automated models, right? So it always starts with human, using human annotations or human annotated data. But we set up, GUIs or graphical user interfaces that could help us annotate, you know, pieces of EEG data more efficiently, that then was used, you know, to in you know, various different models, including CNN or convolutional neural network models, to create algorithms that can then automatically start to annotate. And we sort of went through an iterative process where then the algorithm would annotate the EEG, it would come back to us, and we would agree or disagree. And through multiple rounds, we got to the point where that first model was the SparkNet model, where it basically, you know, the iterator agreement for the model with human experts was the same or even better than human to human iterator agreement. And so we started off with that model, and then using that, you know, a lot of that work has been done by Brandon and his team, where they've advanced it to, you know, more grant, you know, really honing down on seizures and where seizures start and where seizures stop. My group has, at the same time, we've, you know, building from those models basically classify patterns, whether they're present or absent. And we've now used other, you know, other models, using Fourier transform models to actually start to measure the frequency and spatial extent, because that's what matters, right? It's not just the presence or absence. Right. It's the frequency, spatial extent. When you want to look at response to medications, is there a change in frequency? Is there a change in spatial extent? So we're using that foundational model that was initially built on classification, and then on top of that, developing other algorithms to annotate the frequency, spatial extent. And that's what we've worked on and done with a lot of the EEG data.
Oh, amazing. I love that. So tell me a little bit about some of the main objectives that you're applying these kind of foundational models to.
From the for the neurophysiologic data, the goal is just to annotate the EEG to, predict the presence or absence of seizures, periodic and rhythmic patterns, and if they exist or if they're present, what is the frequency at which they're occurring and what is the spatial extent. And then we sort of apply some of the prior work that we did was, we use a sliding window to measure, the peak burden, and then determine, how the peak burden correlates with or impacts discharge as well as long-term functional outcomes. And right now, what we're trying to do is similarly measure the peak burden. So we use sliding windows that we apply across the first 24 hours of recording, for instance, and we can vary the window, whether it's a 3-hour window, 1-hour window, we vary the overlap. We can identify which portion of the EEG has the highest burden, highest frequency, spatial extent, and then use that to sort of, along with all the other clinical covariates that patients have, determine if we can, determine what the independent causal impact is on outcomes. And having developed this model, we've gone from annotating data sets of 300, 400 patients. Our first big project was 2,000 patients, and now we have a data set of 40,000 patients where we've, that has allowed us to annotate all the EEG data. And as a next step, to do any sort of causal inference, of course, we have the EEG data, but you need to measure all their comorbidities, their diagnoses, and then their outcomes as well, which includes functional outcomes as measured by MRS, whether they go on to develop epilepsy or not. And that's where we've started to apply our natural language processing models to EHR data. So a lot of the variables we care about are not available in structured data. Comorbidities or even diagnosis can be extracted using ICD codes, but you and I both know ICD codes are only so reliable. And there's plenty of data showing that, ICD codes on their own, their sensitivity and specificity is suboptimal. And so we started actually using simpler natural language processing models, so bag of word models, for instance, to be able to extract what the patient's diagnosis is. Is it a TBI? Is it subarachnoid hemorrhage? Is it ischemic stroke? And also, their outcomes, including epilepsy. We've created models to extract the modified Rankin score if it's documented to predict it from notes. And to be honest, for most of these, we've used very basic models, like I said, bag of word models. Now, as as with all the various different large language models coming out, et cetera, we started to apply some of those as well, and are using those. And it's interesting, for some of these, the LLMs actually don't significantly improve the performance. So we're finding, depending
When
on
you
what we're
fuse it with
trying.
the EEG, it doesn't add much. Is that what you
Well,
mean?
not with the EEG, with the unstructured electronic health record data from notes, when we're trying to extract data from notes. It really depends on what we're trying to extract. So if you want to pull out, did the patient have a TBI or not, just simple models are sufficient. LLMs are actually start to get very helpful when we're trying to figure out, is this an incident TBI or is this older TBI that we're, that the patient had, or, more like honing it down and making it even more granular.
Have you tried to fuse your LLM with your EEG models?
One thing we've done is, so we the EEG model is all from the raw EEG data, and we have created NLP models on EEG reports, and that again uses a combination of just regexes to pull out if there is a finding reported, and then on top of that LLMs to fine tune. And we found that,
I
those
see.
models, it's under review right now, so fingers crossed, but they have a very high sensitivity and specificity, combining sort of that it's a tiered approach of, simple model regexes and then a final application of LLMs that really helps, hone down the frequency and when the seizure occurred. And what we're really using for this, and this is, I think, what the key is, because I often get asked, you're applying these models to 20 or 30,000 patients, how do you do a quality check for those, right? There's a reason we're using this, because we can't manually review the charts and EEGs of 30,000 patients. So for us, our quality checks have been, whatever we get from like the raw, like our our EEG and like raw EEG annotation models, all the output on pattern, present, frequency, spatial extent, we sort of match that up with whatever we extracted using our natural language processing models from the EEG reports to be able to see that things are actually matching up and aligning, which has been a great quality check as well as reassurance for us, because it does match up. And wherever we're finding major discrepancies, those are the ones where we do a deeper dive. Let's look at the raw data. Let's figure out what the issue is and where, why we have that discrepancy. And it has allowed us to align those even more so that we can reliably use the combination of both models, and increase the confidence and validity of what we're finding or what we're annotating on our EEG.
I mean, ultimately, what would be great would be to have a fused multimodal model to predict who's going to have seizures and who needs prolonged prophylaxis, and some of the epilepsy outcomes that you might be able to get from the EEG. I mean, I think, even adding in imaging, not from EHR reports, but like the raw
Raw
imaging
imaging.
DICOM data in addition to the physiological waveform data and the EEG or LLM data would, most simulate a physician's access to data in terms of predictive capabilities. So that is extremely exciting. What architectures are you guys moving into for your LLM? I know you mentioned you were starting with Bag of Words and now you're using more advanced LLM type of architecture. Do you have any early insights on which performs better, if you're using BERT or GPT or any of these other?
We've tried, we've used BERT, we've used GPT, we've, Llama models, essentially. And for some, so for instance, we compared BERT, what BERT, the BERT models for our epilepsy algorithms. And they were fairly comparable. The initial epilepsy algorithm was Bag of Words, and then we applied BERT. Oftentimes, reviewers asked to compare models. So we actually did one project for a neuroinfectious disease as well, where we had used the more basic model, and then we were asked to add and compared a lot, adding Llama models. And so I think at the end of the day, it really depends on what the question is. And what we found is that we just, we develop multiple models and then, identify which one works the best. And I think every time, for me, the biggest thing is when you're applying this model to new data or when you're actually using it for, the goal is to do natural experiments or to, look at the impact on outcomes. That's where I think you apply your model, but you have to do some quality check to make sure that what you're getting is accurate. And so, I think we found that the Llama models are fairly good, at least with the epilepsy report work that we've done, we found it to be most to improve the accuracy of the EEG reports that we were looking at.
I don't know if you're going to know the answer to this, but I'm curious as to, what kind of techniques you would do to fuse these models. So for example, when we're doing vision-based models or vision transformers and we want to merge with an LLM, we might use LAVA, which is specifically designed to kind of merge imaging and LLM encoders. I don't know what exists in terms of what you might use for physiological data merging with LLM, or if that's too deep in the weeds to get this.
No, so we are to, you bring up imaging. We are actually starting to look also. So to your point, the next step is, you have neurophys data, you have the EHR data. Now can we, add or and include the imaging data as well? And we've actually worked with, we have a collaborator. Are you familiar with Voxel Prompt? That's one of the models that they've developed, at the Martinos that we're using to extract imaging findings. And so that is the next step for us, is working on integrating the outputs from the imaging models, overlapping it with the EEG outputs, both from raw data as well as from report data, and then the EHR. So it's coming up. I haven't actually started to work on that yet, but it's something that we certainly are interested in. And maybe Jen, this is something where maybe you can
help it would be great
and
to
provide.
Collaborate.
I'm wondering about
the portability of some of your models. I know you've worked with Beth Israel, you know, your neighbors, in terms of validating some of your modeling and stuff like that. But, you know, of course you have, I think you have some of the same doctors at these different campuses, and that there might be a lot of similarities between you guys, not to say the least, that you're both in Boston and populations are somewhat similar. And I'm wondering if you have, you know, tried validation at really just very different sites that may have practice variation and documentation variation, et cetera.
No, I think that's a great point. So we've done a lot of our validation work, you're correct, with the BI, where we have most of our collaboration. The doctors are different, so that's at least, you know, one thing, and the note structure, et cetera, is different. But as a part of a lot of the work we're doing, we're actually building a consortium, including other sites. So, you know, so the EEG report work, for instance, has also been validated on Boston Children's. Again, it's regional. So, you know, that is, but, you know, we have collaborations with sites on the West Coast, with Yale, with University of Wisconsin. And so, you know, we're starting to use these, you know, so for instance, a lot of the epilepsy work, Jen Kim, who's at Yale, has been working on and applying the epilepsy algorithms on data there. Mm-hmm. And I think every time you transport it to a new site, there will be, you know, you will have to refine and fine-tune the model.
Fine-tune it locally.
Differences. Mm-hmm. There is some fine-tuning that is required locally, or fine-tuning depending on what project you're doing, you're trying to predict, and what your goal is. But they're fairly easy to pick up and adopt, what I would say. And I think one of the things that we've really worked towards, and this is in the spirit of, you know, even the NIH and data sharing and, you know, collaboration, is that any algorithms and the code and the models that we develop, we do make them available and publish those. So those are available for others to pick up and apply. And if there's, you know, fine tuning needed, we can, we work together and we collaborate. The goal is to help advance science and be collaborative. So that opportunity does exist. But I completely agree, the more we can do in validating this in other places and in other sites, the better it is. For us, at least, I think what is critical is, you know, if my research question, for instance, right now I care about what is the impact of seizures and epileptiform activity on the modified Rankin scale. We have a model that we developed for modified Rankin scale that was developed on the MGB as well as BI data. So, you know, I have confidence in applying this. But the moment I bring in another site or I add another site, you know, I would apply it, but I would have to do a quality check and potentially need to fine tune it as additional sites are added. And I think the more sites we add and the more fine tuning we do, the more and more generalizable these will get.
And so you're just sharing your models and people are running it on their own, like in a sort of federated style on their own data. You're not sharing data in a cloud or merging data from different institutions and running models in the cloud, or everything's going to be run locally, or how have you been doing that?
It's both. We've had folks run models locally. We do have, so there's federated models, but through research collaborations, and this is primarily through NIH grants, where we do have shared data as well. Mm-hmm. The Brain Data Science platform is the platform that we have, where you can also publish your own data and code. It's an NIH approved repository, but we've used that platform also to share data as approved by data use agreements and, you know, grants and funding, etc. And can do some analytics on cloud-based formats as well. So both are, both are options. The code is available for you to use locally. And if there's interest in collaborating, then we have ways to collaborate through the infrastructure of the Brain Data Science platform as well.
So the expense of the compute so far, has that wound up being prohibitive for any of your projects or... Not yet.
Great question. It is a limitation, but I think so. That's for me at least. You know, for all our projects, right now they're being funded by the NIH. So I include the computing costs in that. You know, that's what, like with research collaborators, we ensure that we have sufficient computing costs. But yes, to run some of these larger models, of course, you need a lot more computing power. And that's something that you need to, you know, keep in mind.
Some of your work, I think, is moving towards, when you're talking about simulated clinical trials, is moving maybe towards even the concept of digital twins. And I'm wondering, is that one of your goals to generate a digital twin library for seizures in the NeurICU and outcomes and so forth? Or what does that look like?
No, that's a great question. I think for me, what we've talked about some of that as a research group or consortium with collaborators. I think for me, my personal interest really more is, and as a next step is, you know, once we have all this like richly granularly annotated data to use more novel causal inference and epidemiologic methods. So for instance, we're designing some emulated target trials using methodology developed by actually several folks at the Harvard School of Public Health as well, where you can, you know, basically apply the principles of whatever randomized control trial you think is the right trial on observational data. And then you can, you know, vary your exposures or outcomes, and it gives you sort of some of the flexibility to do that. And then simultaneously doing other more machine learning reinforcement type learning type simulations to, you know, provide exposure to different treatments. And then, you know, it's sort of like playing a video game with treatment exposure and varying the response using observational data to guide that. So my interest, right, for me, you know, personally, that's where most of my interest lies, is in using this data to, you know, look at treatment strategies, do natural experiments using real world data. But there is a potential, yes, to, you know, create digital twins using this type of data. And I think my collaborator, Brandon Westover, that's some of the work that him and his group are also working on.
Let me end this by asking, what is your, you know, in 5 years, what is your dream to have accomplished using all of this AI work that you've really, you know, pioneered and pushed forward? Where would you like to see us in terms of our capabilities in the neuro ICU for prognostication or capabilities of treating epilepsy within the neuro ICU setting?
Wow, that is such a hard question to answer. You know, I think my hope really is that using these technologies, we're really able to move the needle on ideally multimodal monitoring in the neuro ICU. And it's not just EEG monitoring. For me, I think 5 years from now, my goal would be that I've solved the question of who to give anti-seizure medications to, how much, for how long, and when to wean them off is sort of, right, you know, is what I, is my dream.
Medications?
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you come in with a traumatic brain injury based on your injury severity and your clinical profile. Should you or should you not get prophylaxis? Or if you have seizures, or periodic and rhythmic patterns, should you or should you not get seizure medications? Should you stay on them during the hospital and then be weaned off, or should you stay on them for 3 months? So really outlining that piece, I think, is my vision. But I think my hope is that all the methodologies that we're developing can also just in general move the needle on how to optimize multimodal monitoring in the neuro ICU. I think, you know, the BOOST trial is an amazing trial that we're doing. But I think outside of that work right now, we talk about ICP monitoring, microdialysis, brain tissue, you know, all the various monitoring. Uh-huh. We know that it helps identify secondary brain injury, but we have yet to demonstrate that using all this monitoring does, you know, improve short as well as long-term outcomes. And so my hope is that this sort of work can help complement efforts such as the BOOST trial and other upcoming trials or work that will be looking at multimodal monitoring and developing methods that you can use AI technologies and provide, you know, providing precision medicine and improving outcomes when we use multimodal monitoring.
Wonderful. Thank you. And it's true, we're leaving a lot of data on the table. We're even leaving all of our basic vital sign physiological continuous waveform data on the table that we could probably harness. You know, so using what we have in a smarter way, which, you know, you really need AI and machine learning to evaluate this data and the relationships between different physiological parameters to actually understand what's going on. So it's exciting. It's a
It
great
is.
time to be a neurointensivist.
I agree. I mean, I think one thing I would also add is using, using this data also to design data-driven trials, right? Or data-driven pragmatic trials. I think is a way forward. The way we design trials right now, I know that there's a lot of thought that goes into them, but oftentimes, when if you don't know what the right endpoint is, it's hard. What is the right brain tissue oxygenation that we should be targeting, for instance? And
Or
so,
the right population, or the right, what is the effect size? Is this even feasible, you know?
exactly. And so I think for me, we did some of this, we did this for subarachnoid hemorrhage patients, for instance, where we did a little, simulation for trying to, model data-driven RCT and, for anti-seizure medications. And we played around with if this is the dose that we used and if this is the efficacy, if we use population level efficacy and if we vary that, we basically ended up with, you need at least 1,000 patients per arm for this trial to be successful. And so, and that was just, looking at a small cohort of subarachnoid hemorrhage patients. But I think there's so much opportunity when there's all this data sitting around, like you said, to use it to create, to design the a more feasible trial as well for whatever question it is that we're interested in.
I mean, I think in the critical care medicine literature writ large, their favorite outcome of 30-day mortality is not really a reasonable outcome for a lot of different interventions we're interested in, right? So people aren't going to die from seizure prophylaxis or having a breakthrough seizure in all likelihood. So of course you're going to have a negative trial if that's your endpoint. So being a little bit more savvy about, endpoint selection, to your point, I think is also incredibly important. So with that, I thank you for coming on
Thank you
and
for
having a
having
nice
me.
chat. I'm excited to see, your future work coming out, and I'm hopeful that we can set up some collaborations. I think we already did try to validate your MRS scale in our data set. So we'll meet
We'll meet
we'll meet
about
next week and show you
that.
how it performed with the NYU data. Hopefully well, because I think it's a great idea to save a lot of time for extracting outcomes that are of interest. But anyway, continue to be impressed, and I hope we can work together in the future soon. And
Thanks,
thank
Cheryl.
you.
So nice to see you. All right.